Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to the complicated issues we face today. Today's guest is Harmeet Dhillon, a nationally recognized attorney whose focus is commercial litigation, employment law, First Amendment rights, and election law matters. She is the managing partner and a trial lawyer at Dhillon Law Group in San Francisco. She's also CEO and founder of the Center for American Liberty and the co-chair of the Republican National Lawyers Association. Harmeet graduated from Dartmouth, where she was the editor-in-chief of the Dartmouth Review, and then the University of Virginia Law School, where she was the editor of the Virginia Law Review. Harmeet and I have a wide-ranging conversation about key issues like free speech, the current state of our system of justice, and whether or not it's politicized, separation of powers, especially involving Congress and the Supreme Court, and a variety of other things that are important today and in the news. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Harmeet, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Well, there's so many things going on in our legal system. As an outside observer, it's hard to keep track of everything. So I'm going to jump in with a few things that you have special expertise in. And the first big one really is freedom of speech. And freedom of speech now, to me, it's the most fundamental right that we have in a free society. And we're seeing it being exercised, and there's a lot of controversy around it, particularly first on protests, college campuses, and all of the Middle East issues going on. I'd like to hear your thoughts on what do we mean by free speech in its legal sense, and in what ways are these things being exceeded or not exceeded?
Well, thank you. I am very passionate about the First Amendment, and that's really where we in the United States gather our free speech rights from. Of course, that's where they're enumerated. I believe these are fundamental human rights. Now, the First Amendment protects your right to free speech in various aspects, but it's not absolute. And what we're seeing on college campuses today is really testing the limits of free speech and where the line is between speech that is your right to express your views and speech and actions that are impeding other people's rights. And so that's really where I think a lot of people are confused. They think they have the right to go on a college campus, even if they're from off campus, and block access to buildings, in fact, even violently attack people, and that's free speech. It is not. So let's first start with the public-private divide. So there are different free speech rights when you're protesting in a public place, including on a public college campus, or in front of a post office, or on a sidewalk or a road, which is public, versus a private college campus or some other limited purpose facility. So when you see people protesting on some of our public university campuses, those are not public access free speech venues typically, but parts of them are. Sidewalks are, roads are. Universities usually designate free speech areas, and the inside of a classroom typically is not a public forum for free speech, whereas the roadway and your access to the campus may very well be. So you have to know where you are before you undertake as to what you can say and do.
Okay.
There.
So blocking other people from the function or blocking the entity or the corporation or the university from its function is a violation.
And that's
right. So it seems like, you know, certainly in protests in the United States in our history, I mean, we've all seen, whether it's in the past few years or even when we were kids with civil rights or other issues, protests that are, I would guess, only effective when they do block other people, because that's what makes the news. And so given what you just said, what legal remedies are there by the police or anyone else? So both public access, but also even in a confined environment like the campus of a university, to get rid of those people that are, to eliminate the blockage, to eliminate the interference. I mean, I think that what we're seeing is that this is a question, I mean, as just a normal individual citizen that I have, at what point is it okay for the police to physically remove these people? And at what point is it not?
So protesting outside a building, even to the point where your voice is heard inside, can be legal. It depends on first where the university has set their areas for protest. As a First Amendment lawyer, I would say that the area for protest should be pretty broad. But where the Supreme Court has drawn the line is that if you're really blocking access to the building to the point where it is making the building useless or the function for which it is intended useless. For example, if you're blocking access to a post office, if you're blocking access to the science lab or the history lab or the Jewish Students Association area in a university, then you're acting illegally. And the government can enforce its trespassing laws. The university police can do that. Back when I was at Dartmouth College, which is a private institution, there were protesters occupying the dean's office and the Baker Library at Dartmouth, and you know they were hauled away. You know, typically universities don't end up prosecuting people because they're kind of soft on protesters and they want to encourage speech. But they have the right to do that, and the police can prosecute you for certainly violent acts, destructive acts, defacing property, and so that's really what we're seeing throughout the United States is. Going beyond, and I fully support the rights of people who, if you support Hamas, which I, you know, violently disagree with, but if you support Hamas, you have a right to say that and wave Palestinian flags, but you don't have a right to prevent Jewish students from getting to campus or to prevent or exclude professors from getting onto the campus people.
Okay, there's a second part of it to me, which is separate from literally blocking access, and that is this idea of intimidation, harassment, threatening mm-hmm. speech.
Sure.
What do we get? How far can we go with speech, and who decides if it's a threat? And if it's a threat, is that illegal, or how does that get remedied?
Well, there's threats and there's threats. And so and there's a complex combination of criminal law and First Amendment law there. But the old saw that you hear about the First Amendment is, hate speech isn't protected. Hate speech is absolutely protected by the Constitution. And then you get into violent speech. And so if it's like, hey, I'm going to kick your butt, and you're like a, 3 foot tall, scrawny person or a child, like that's not considered to be a true threat. It's not considered to be incitement to violence. If you're a big protester with arms, including a big flag that's got a 6 foot pole on it, and you're physically fit, and there's 10 of you violently threatening and blocking people, then that is a very different matter. If you have the ability to incite fear and incite violence in other people, and that violence is imminent, that's the narrow point at which speech can become action. So a court has to decide that on a case by case basis. But we've seen instances of, we've seen video of actual people locking themselves into a building for fear of violent assault. I think that's the point at which that line has been crossed.
And when people who are the subject of the perceived threatening speech, like, for example, the students on a campus who are Jewish who feel that they are being threatened, do they have a legal remedy? In other words, do they, and if they do, meaning a lawsuit, and do they sue the university for failure to protect their freedom, their safety, or do they sue the people doing the hateful, violent speech?
Well, I think they have potential remedies against both. And so there's federal law that requires all educational institutions to protect people on the basis of race, religion, gender is Title IX, but then there are other areas. So for example, a university has a absolute duty to protect Black students from white supremacists on campus who are, threatening them in any imminent harm way. And the same is true of Jewish students, people who are being targeted for their religion. So I think there is a potential cause of action against a university that is not sort of on a one-off, unprepared, or did a bad job, but is systematically enabling harassment and intolerance. And in the case of Columbia, allegedly even locking a professor off of the campus for his own safety, that's not constitutional, that's not right. And then in terms of the individuals who are doing it, that depends on state law. And so, for example, in many states, there's a civil remedy for false imprisonment. So if you're effectively blocking someone's egress or leaving a building, that's false imprisonment. That's really detaining them there beyond the scope of their liberty. I think there are also, I've certainly been looking at some creative tort measures. We've seen people block the Bay Bridge or the Golden Gate Bridge here in San Francisco, to the point where I think at least one person was unable to get their organ transplant because the organ could not be transplanted in time to be useful. This is horrible. And so, you know, you have to be able to be within a zone of what is protected by tort law to be able to sue over that. But I do think it's possible. And I personally sued, for example, Antifa for violently assaulting a journalist, Andy Ngo, in Portland. And, you know, we were partially successful in that regard.
What about the idea of who calls in the police? Who calls in the protective remedies of these universities? Let's talk about universities still. Because we've read or seen in the news, and it's hard to believe without knowing, but who is it up to the university to determine if the police are needed, or because this is really... it may be a private university, but it seems it's a public property, that the mayor or the governor decides this is unacceptable? Or, you know, whose responsibility is it, and who gets the official bottom line authority to decide if protests are still okay or not okay?
Right. So that's a great question, because there are actually many, many layers of authority. So ultimately, you can have a private campus in Texas, for example, but ultimately it's in Texas. So if crimes are occurring there, terrorism is occurring there, rapes are occurring there, then the local authorities have certain rights. In practicality, most universities have evolved their own sort of campus police and have evolved some detente with the town versus gown dilemma. So some detente with the local community that for the most part, they'll police their own campus and only call in the authorities when they need additional help. So that's kind of the status quo on most campuses. So that said, if you were under attack in a building, you're a student, and someone is preventing you from leaving, or someone is physically assaulting you, you can call 911 or 311 here and get police to come to the campus. They won't stop at the border of the campus and say, no, we can't proceed if there's an ongoing crime. But ultimately, sure, a governor has a right, if there are widespread protests happening that disrupt the peace, to call in the National Guard and to reestablish order in the area of that state that is out of order.
So they can do that regardless of what a university president deems appropriate.
Absolutely. I mean, even on private property, crimes are not permitted in our country.
Okay. So, and now let me ask something else, because, you know, we see some of these buildings being occupied, for instance, literally occupied, or we see camps in a way of tent residing students or non-students. I don't know who these people are. No one does, really. You know, and I just want, this is an occupation of property, even if it does not prevent access necessarily. What about that?
Well, I think it does in a way. So I give you the example of back when I was in college. There were protests similar to the ones today that were in favor of divestment from South African companies or companies that did business there and were supposedly profiting from apartheid. And I would argue that if you are building a shanty town on the campus green that is meant for other purposes, let's say, for example, the free speech of everybody, the free speech of others, maybe you want to have a prayer vigil over there, you are effectively occupying that property to the exclusion of others. And that is a free speech violation of the other students. And so I don't think that is permitted. And in fact, every university has now come out and said, you can protest. We've cherished your right to protest. You can't start building structures and preventing access and occupying it to the exclusion of everybody else. It's a common space. It's a common area. Are they enforcing that? One's experience varies depending on the institution. Usually the more expensive it is to go there, the less they're enforcing the law. Mm-hmm.
Let's shift into a different sort of free speech issue, which we've seen, you know, exposed, if not started during this pandemic management and everything that's happened since then. And that is this, the direct censorship of speech in this in social media, which from my, again, layman point of view, social media is the town square these days. It's not just like a newspaper. It's a little bit different. What are the real key issues we should think about with this so-called censorship, with or without the government being involved? It's a private company, and so it seems like there's a lot of ambiguity in what they can and cannot censor, determined to be appropriate.
So, Scott, you've asked the fundamental question that is the most important free speech issue before the Supreme Court this year and this term, and I would argue for the last decade, and that is, to what extent can private entities censor our speech in what is now what we all understand as the town square, first of all, on their own, which now we know they don't do it on their own, but that was a question I asked earlier in litigation now pending before the Supreme Court, or secondly, at the behest of the government, right? And so what we have seen now, what it looked like for many years, and this is before the pandemic, was that these free speech so-called platforms, Facebook, Twitter, others, that they were populated by woke employees, woke CEOs, liberals, and they selectively censored people's speech. That was our user experience. And you knew if you got too far out there in favor of President Trump or used certain rhetoric or expressed certain views, you were likely to have your reach either throttled or simply you would be summarily executed from the public square. That was thought to be something that these companies were doing because of viewpoint discrimination of their own, which, by the way, is not protected by the First Amendment. Companies have a right to have their viewpoint, okay? So I went at this with a novel approach, which is these companies, which, you know, we all sign up, some of us pay to be part of them now, but it used to be free, and they have user terms. And so that's a contract with the public, where public is using under a contract. So if the contract doesn't specify that they can take you off for your views, then I think that's a breach of contract, and users have a right to take legal action. So all of this started to come to a head after the 2020 election. And it was bubbling up before that with the censorship of prominent physicians and scientists like yourself when it came time to criticizing mandatory widespread vaccination of the entire public, for example, as opposed to those people who are most at risk, or mask mandates or COVID lockdowns. Many scientists in the world were criticizing this, and they were getting their reach throttled, and they would be suspended for their views, et cetera, et cetera. And we didn't really know where that was coming from. Well, in the 2020 election, after that, there are people like my client, Rogan O'Hanley, who criticized the conducting of that election, questioned whether Joe Biden had legitimately won the most votes in history of any U.S. president, and they were taken down from social media. And so what we learned a few months after that was, through Public Records Act requests, that the state of California, that's the first evidence we had, the state of California paid $25 million to a consulting firm to identify speech that was quote unquote dangerous or inappropriate under with respect to the election. And then the state secretary of state worked with these social media companies to take down the speech that the government dollars had identified as inappropriate. Okay. So we learned that after the fact. We filed a lawsuit, which is Rogan O'Hanley versus Twitter et al. And versus the state of California. That was alleging public-private action partnership. And the idea was, well, Twitter and Instagram and the other wouldn't have taken the speech down if it hadn't been for the government action. So that implicates the First Amendment. And we lost that in the district court. We lost that in the Ninth Circuit. And that case is now pending before the Supreme Court. At the same time, a little bit later, actually, I should say a year or two later, there was the Missouri versus Murthy case. And that was a series of attorneys general suing on behalf of medical and scientific professionals for a similar type of censorship. And what we learned at that point was that the federal government was actually involved in doing the exact same thing that I just described the state of California doing, namely telling these social media companies what to censor in the name of quote unquote public safety or what have you, wrong thing, group think, you name it. And so the argument in the Fifth Circuit and the argument, sorry, in the lower court there was really over what did the government use coercion or not? That was really the linchpin of the Fifth Circuit's analysis. So the idea is, well, the government has a right to express its opinion. That's a well-settled constitutional premise. But does the government have the right to implicitly condition your social media company's continued existence or lack of regulation on your decision to censor or not? Exactly what we're asking you to do. And so the court kind of split the baby in the Fifth Circuit and went through all of that and decided, well, certain government officials had the ability and even threatened to increase regulation and censorship on these companies, really forcing them to comply with the jackboot of the state behind it. And so now that is before the Supreme Court as to whether that coercion analysis is the correct analysis, whether it's sufficient, as I would argue that simply government resources were expended and the government was telling these companies. I mean, to me, the police power is implied.
Right.
Every corporation is a fiction created by the government. Every corporation has the ability to suddenly see itself subject to higher regulation, taxation, investigation. The government can punish all of us by simply opening up an investigation. And so I think that the court should paint very broadly in that regard. And so there are a couple of other cases like our case that are awaiting the outcome of that Supreme Court ruling to apply a certain test. And this is going to be really a earth-shattering moment, because if the Supreme Court rules that, for example, my theory, which is if government resources are used combined with government communication, even through an intermediary to a social media company, that's state action. And the First Amendment must apply, and very little censorship is going to be allowed in that framework. If the rule is instead something having to do with, well, they have, you know, actually did threaten that we will take away your license to, we will increase FEC, FTC, name the alphabets regulation on you if you don't do this, then it's a little bit of a slipperier slope and there'll be less speech encompassed by that First Amendment analysis. But I think the court is poised to do something in that regard and create a new rule for us that's really going to be very different. And of course, what's interesting now is the new owner of Twitter, not new anymore, has a very different viewpoint and has in fact is battling censorship of this nature throughout the world. We in the United States often get, you know, sort of a little bit of a tunnel vision thinking, oh, this is happening to us. But censorship is legal and common throughout most of the world, including much of the English-speaking world. And so these social media companies are routinely getting requests in India. There are protests by farmers over government regulations on farming. And so, for example, Indian government has demanded that Twitter simply block not just that speech, but also those speakers. I'm not sure I'm able to be seen in India because I've been a very vocal, kind of critic of the government in that regard. And so, you know, this is going to have monumental impact on the world, really, because if it becomes a rule in the United States that censorship by the government is not allowed, I think that is going to have a trickle-down effect throughout the rest of the world.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but or at least my concern really, to me, it's lower-hanging fruit when, again, like I'm not a lawyer, but when the government is involved in saying censor these people or this company or these views, that to me is more clearly a contestable point. But what about when just the company itself, because to me, I don't think any of us really know, but it seems clear to me that when I was in the White House in 2020, for instance, it was not the government telling Twitter to take my account down. It was not the government telling YouTube to take my interviews down. They did it on their own. And these companies, I want to get it. This is much more complicated, I have a feeling, is that when the private company just decides, the workers themselves in that company decide to block you or to take it down, when we are in a society that virtually all of the information for many people, if not most, comes through these social media outlets, to me, that's effectively censoring information, whether or not the government does it. I don't see how that's legal. And I want to make a corollary point here. This is not over. My interview about 2 months ago was taken down by YouTube because a part of the interview was asking me about the data on vaccines. And I said simply the data. I didn't even express an opinion, yet it was taken down by YouTube. A talk I gave in 2023 at University of Colorado in Boulder, the lecture itself was all filled with slides about data. It was taken down by YouTube and then reinstated when the university went back to them. So this is still going on, and it's not necessarily mainly directed by the government.
All right. Well, so again, you've really put your finger on one of the most active undecided issues by the court. And so this concept of private property and, of course, the social media companies, which have been paid for, developed to the tune of billions of dollars of investment by these companies, they're private companies, right? So I think we can all agree on that. And they have shareholders and they make profits based on advertising. And so YouTube has long been the most notorious censor of these companies, and Google itself is a pretty bad censor. At the same time, they freely appropriate your property and use it for their private purposes. They block you from using their property for your private purposes. And so is that fair? Is that reasonable? Well, the courts so far have held that private companies can have their own rules, and they have their own free speech rights, right? And while there has been an isolated ruling here and there on the idea of private property occasionally becoming public property, like in the case of the town square analysis, those cases are really very narrow. There was a Supreme Court ruling that said that a company town back in the, you know, Dust Bowl or something had certain aspects of the First Amendment that could apply. California has a case involving shopping centers, leafleting in a shopping center. But on the other hand, there have been the Hare Krishnas who used to be plaguing every American airport, and they've been stopped from doing that because those spaces are not designated as public fora under traditional First Amendment analysis. So the court has yet to rule that what you've articulated, namely that this digital town square is open for business for all legal purposes. So the hard questions come, for example, on issues like pornography. Personally, I like a user experience on what's now called X, where I don't see pornography throughout my feed. That's their preference. There are other social media companies where anything goes. And then there are others which have chosen to set some rules and have a cleaner environment. I actually think that's fine. But what I think we get into a slippery slope is what one of my other clients, Megan Murphy, ran into well before all of this COVID stuff, and that is a ad hoc censorship that occurs on these companies. I mentioned the contract issue. So you should know in advance that if you do X, that Y will occur. That's our principle of contract law. Well, what these social media companies have been doing, you mentioned an example. Is there a rule somewhere that says questioning the efficacy of untested experimental vaccines on children is something we should really take a beat on? Is there such rule written down in YouTube? There is not. There's no such rule that I'm aware of that you would know and read and shape your behavior accordingly. My client got put into X, then Twitter jail, for using the wrong pronouns. Now, at the time she used the wrong pronouns, one of the notorious transgender activists in Canada, there was no rule on the Twitter platform that says that you could be removed from the platform for quote-unquote misgendering. And yet she was removed exactly for that. We lost that case. The court said under a federal law called the Communications Decency Act of 1996, passed with very good intentions in mind, that the companies can do whatever they want. I find this highly problematic because in virtually every other sphere, I can sue a company for breaching their promises to me. This is a consumer protection. I like that as a lawyer. I like that as an American. I have rights. Well, you, the user, you, Scott Atlas, have no rights when it comes to these companies arbitrarily making up rules, changing the rules midstream, and censoring you. And I have repeatedly gone before Congress and urged Congress to pass a user's bill of rights that gives social media users certain rights, a private right of action, the ability to sue. And, you know, I think this is something that's really important, and we don't have that yet. So while my Republican friends on the Hill pay lip service and invite me to talk about these issues, in reality, they actually don't do anything about it. And that's very frustrating.
Yes, it is. It's frustration on many levels at different areas. You know, I grew up in the era where there were, you know, very few TV networks. And I'm in the era of George Carlin, the famous comedian who listed the 7 or 9 or whatever dirty words that couldn't be said. These were words, though, this is sort of getting back to the same issue. It's very subjective what is deemed inappropriate, for lack of a better word. It reminds me of what I think was a saying said by one of the Supreme Court judges, and you know this, pornography, the definition is you know it when you see it. So it's all subjective. And I feel like in the world we're in, you know, people talk about different standards. It seems to me, in my own view, that no one really is capable of determining what's appropriate or not, ultimately. And why isn't there a move to say, okay, more information is better. We're in a world that was the promise of the internet. That was the whole point of all this access to information. I sort of wonder this sort of libertarianish view seems a reasonable solution. I don't know what people are afraid of, I guess, is what I'm asking. What is the fear of hearing the information? Maybe that's just personal philosophy.
Yeah, so here's the answer to that. I'm going to play devil's advocate because I'm not saying it's my answer, but the answer to that is there's a couple of answers. So first of all, I told you as a consumer, as a woman, I like to go on Twitter and X and express my views and not see pornography bombarding me. If you like, or you're a libertarian, you think pornography in between, you know, commentary on wars and on social movements is desirable, you can go to Gab and some others. But the argument that is often, I've been in debates at the Federalist Society with professors on free speech issues, and they always say, well, you know, there's a marketplace of ideas means there's competition. So, you know, I mean, if you don't like X and Twitter and YouTube, and you can just go start your own, spend your own $50 billion to start your own. That's, of course, nonsense. And what we've actually seen is when people have tried to do that, with Parler is a great example, that they just cut you off at the knees somewhere else, upstream. So they take away your server access, or they take away your banking. They take away other aspects of that. So I think we are in a real area of flux right now. The courts hasn't set rules on that, but people have had their banking rights taken away for their views in the United States. John Eastman, a learned professor who is now being criminally harassed for his views on the 2020 election, and advice he gave, has been debanked. Right. I personally represented people who sell American flags, and PayPal has, you know, blocked them from getting access to the cash from what they sold. The credit card companies, MasterCard and other, have dipped their toes in this water, and they've been spanked. People have threatened to sue them, and they've kind of backed off. And so I would love to see more guidance. By the way, back to Congress, it's, you know, we can't really rely on the courts to make up the rules for everything. It's inappropriate. They should be doing interstitial gap filling and not making up rules. But Congress should be doing that. But what I've seen time and time again is Republican congressmen proudly, thinking of one, I won't mention the name, former congressman who, you know, proudly tours Facebook and Twitter and and, you know, they get donations from these companies, from Google, from others. The tech lobby gives money to my side of the fence, the Republican side. And then nothing happens. And they buy this, you know, corporations have free speech rights and corporations win. And this is a vestige of, you know, the Reagan era, really, as Republicans have worshipped corporations to the point where the individual citizen, which is really what is protected under the Constitution, our rights are gone. So I would love to see that pendulum swing back. I think there would be bipartisan support in certain regards for users' Bill of Rights on social media. And, you know, so that the loser pays. The company violates your articulated rights, your lawyer gets their attorney's fees paid by the company. That would right the overwhelming disadvantage right now. Right now, if you want to sue one of these social media companies, you're usually forced into an arbitration clause, usually by some captive arbitrator right here in San Francisco, who never rules against the government. Or you have a judge here in San Francisco who never rules against, not the government, sorry, but the social media companies. So there needs to be more neutrality in that analysis. And there needs to be more rights on the side of the citizen and the user, in my opinion.
I'm going to take that as a sort of a segue into this bigger topic of the politicization of the justice system. Because you're sort of mentioning how some of the judges or whatever are biased or have a tendency to, rule one way or the other in terms of corporate versus individual. But here we're seeing something else that is, to me, even more worrisome. Again, as just a regular citizen, it seems to me that there's an unequal application of justice in the United States now. I think it's shocking, frankly, to see the weaponization of the justice system used for a political process. And in this case, of course, the elephant in the room we're talking about is President Trump with all of these indictments. People talk about, I have my own conversations about this with my own children, and I hear the phrase when somebody says, well, when Hillary Clinton broke up the emails that she had and destroyed evidence after it was subpoenaed, there was no problem with that. But then we have this sort of focus on President Trump and et cetera. And I'm called, okay, that's whataboutism. And my answer is whataboutism in the law, the system of law is really, that's the basis of justice is precedent and the equal application of justice. And it seems to me that this is a new era. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I've been naive. Maybe this existed all the time. What's going on? Is it accurate to say that the Department of Justice and the justice system in general is now politicized in the United States?
Okay, so first let me respond by saying I represent President Trump and my law firm represents his campaign in multiple different areas. And so I think the answer to your question is yes, absolutely, when it comes to President Trump and when it comes to certain other types of people. I also represent David Elyden, a very prominent journalist who is being persecuted by the state of California for undercover taping, which is something that all the liberal entities do, 60 Minutes does, other people do. Nobody prosecutes them for exposing corrupt behavior in the part of corporations. But when David Elyden exposed corrupt behavior on the part of Planned Parenthood, illegal behavior, he is being prosecuted for undercover taping in this state, the only journalist ever for that to happen. And there's been a motion pending in front of the court for years now on selective prosecution. There's literally no other cases like his. And yet, you know, the courts are dodging it. I think judges are literally rather retiring than answer this question. This case has been going on for so many years. The same is true in President Trump's case. It runs into two things. So first of all, there is a real problem, and this is just a meta problem, if you will, of, again, our lawmakers passing a bunch of laws trying to look tougher than the other, particularly in election years. So there's a whole bunch of federal statutes on the books right now. Any of us on any given day, I am not exaggerating, is violating some federal statute or the other. You know, it's a per se crime to pick up an eagle feather and put it in your pocket in a national park, whether you knew that's a crime or not. These are crimes. And so there's a bunch of crimes on the books. This gives federal prosecutors overwhelming power to overcharge crimes, to pile crimes on top of each other, to, you know, threaten people with 100-year sentences for bookkeeping issues that their staff did when they were the president. I mean, literally some of the things that President Trump is on trial for right now in a Manhattan courtroom are things that other people did in his name that are long past the statute of limitations. They're only currently on trial because a prosecutor, after several of the prosecutors turned it down, has been told or decided for his own reasons that he needs to get President Trump. And so they've bootstrapped a not crime of a campaign finance violation onto these not crimes of bookkeeping issues to try to make a Frankenstein out of it. And what it is doing, first of all, persecuting a presidential candidate during the time he should be out campaigning, but it is decreasing public trust in the law, which is a real problem for me as a lawyer. And it is angering people. It's likely to have the opposite effect. I think it's rather than having a decreasing his popularity as a candidate, which is literally why the left is persecuting him this way. And the governors and have criticized him in these blue states. the Attorney General of New York, who's in a long line of really shady people as Attorney General of New York, has openly said she wants to get him and has done that herself in the prosecution of his business, the civil prosecution of his business.
But and even so, separate from the impact on the election itself, I think you're pointing out the bigger picture issue, really, which is when you have a country where the citizens don't trust the system of justice, to me, you've lost the country. The country's finished. You can't have a country that we end up becoming like Brazil or somewhere, which is going on right now, putting people in jail. And the question is, what is the backstop here? Is there a backstop intact? Is it always just the Supreme Court that's the backstop? Because it seems to me that we have multiple judges in these state or other trials that seem politicized. And I just, I'm sort of frantic in a way as an individual here. What is going on if we have a system of justice that's out of control? I don't feel safe in a country where there's not a legitimate system of justice.
Well, I'd love to tell you, don't worry, but I'm as worried as you are. Okay, so what I have seen, for example, the idea that Fannie Willis in Georgia was not subject to disqualification there, I would be subject to disqualification. If I went into a court and I had those conflicts of interest and I were a prosecutor, you better believe it. First of all, it wouldn't have happened because I would never have put myself in that position. But the judge in New York is not just like, I think Grinevant Susteren and I got into a back and forth on Twitter over this issue where I replied to her. She said, well, it's an appearance of impropriety for a judge to preside when his daughter has a financial interest as a political consultant in making money off of this trial. It's actually worse than that. There's a New York state statute that requires a judge to recuse themselves when any of a long list of relatives benefits financially from their trial. And the judge has simply refused to do that. The Court of Appeals has refused to force him to do that. This was appealed and this was rejected.
Yeah, so here's what we're talking about.
That's crazy. They're just ignoring the law.
The rules exist.
Right.
And they're just being blatantly ignored.
And not only that, the left is literally threatening the Supreme Court. I mean, we've seen United States presidents, Obama and Biden, stand at the State of the Union and literally look Supreme Court justices in the eye and basically threaten them. Like, you know, the court is out of control and the court, we're going to, you know, change the court. Well, you can forget about that being the backstop of liberty. I heard some encouraging questioning from the court last week, you know, in that argument over immunity in April. And it was encouraging, but you could change the composition of the court.
Yeah, is that
with
a realistic?
With a stroke of the pen.
Is this I'm sorry to interrupt. Is
well,
that
if
realistic?
Democrats win this election, so if Democrats sweep this election in 2024, winning both the White House and sufficient majority in the Senate and the House, I don't think they're going to do that. But if they did, there could be a court packing scheme. It has been threatened by many presidents in the past, always Democrats. And they could threaten to pack the court. They could put term limits on there, which would get rid of the most conservative justices. And they could stuff it with, you know, ideologues like, you know, a couple of the one recent appointee, I would say. And that would be catastrophic because right now the Supreme Court, by the way, to be very clear, only hears about 80 cases in a good year. And there are millions of cases throughout the country. So the idea that the Supreme Court's going to save you when the state court screws you over is a fallacy. Most of the time, it isn't going to happen.
They're not involved.
The case
they
can't.
Right.
There are only nine of them. Some of them are older. They have a really light workload, quite frankly, and they handle only the most important cases. Most cases never get that judicial review, and people are in prison because they got an unfair trial in this country. And people's rights and businesses have been taken away. There's civil asset forfeiture where the government even accuses you of a crime. They take your stuff and then they ask questions later. So there's a lot of wrongs that need to be righted in our court system. And we need, ultimately, my view as a citizen is that this is a crisis. If I had known when I went into law school in 1990, I started law school at University of Virginia, that this would be what the profession is today. You couldn't rely on judges to do the right thing. You couldn't rely on the courts to be transparent. your rights may be violated. I might not have gone into this profession. I might have gone into your profession.
Oh, I'm not
Scott, sure. Although we see that that's not any different now.
Yeah. I think we would all rethink what we did, although I can't say I have regrets, but I can say that things have changed. And I think we're now far more aware about what's going on, even in our own fields, than we were. I think some of the stuff was there and we didn't realize it. I think a lot of things have been exposed. You know, I want to ask to finish with two quick things. One is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we talk about the swing vote on the Supreme Court. And I've thought about this a little bit, and maybe I'm completely wrong, but it seems to me always the swing vote is a justice that was appointed by a Republican. Is there ever a swing vote on the Supreme Court, a justice who's identified as the swing voter, who was appointed by the Democrat? Because what I see is there's a real consistency of voting by the liberal justices, the quote-unquote liberal justices, and it's always one of the conservative justices who's the swing voter, whether it's Kennedy or whoever it was before then. Is that wrong?
Well, I think it's correct in recent years when there's been a conservative majority on the court, and there have been other times when there's been the occasional liberal justice who will peel off from the liberal majority when there have been liberal majorities and vote in an unpredictable way. So it has been both ways in our history. But of course, you know, right now, Justice Barrett, you know, or Justice Kavanaugh or Justice Roberts has been the swing vote on things like Obamacare,
right,
or other issues, or even declining to vote to grant certiorari in important cases in the 2020 election. There were rampant, multiple, many state violations of fundamental constitutional rights, as well as voting rights that are enshrined in state law or constitution. The Supreme Court just threw up its hands and declined to review any of them. Pennsylvania was a great case of that. And so, you know, that's a political decision,
right,
to not hear a case. That's a political decision
at that point. I wonder if it's just simply the same problem that plagues every aspect of our society, which is that people just don't have the courage to do what's right, and they listen to the politics of it, which I sort of am totally disgusted about that kind of lack of courage, but that's a separate topic for another day. The last question, which is, again, maybe naive, but it seems to me that in terms of the remedies of what a president does, the issue of can they be sued or convicted of crimes while they're president, isn't that exactly what's being addressed by the impeachment process? Isn't that already in the Constitution that if a president does, quote, high crimes or misdemeanors, they're impeached? That's it. And if they're not impeached and convicted, that is the process. I don't see why this is even being entertained, actually. Now, maybe that I'm just like very simplistic in this.
Well, so here's the issue. The issue is that impeachment for official acts is arguably, I would say definitely, the sole remedy of critics of the president for any of his official acts while in Congress. But the question that remains open, and the one that was briefed and argued in the Supreme Court recently, is what about private behavior? What about, you know, strangling your wife or committing a murder, you know, something like that that's not an official act? What about, in this specific case, your communications with your private attorneys about your private interests as a candidate versus your public interests as a president? So this is where it gets a little messier, and the rule articulated before the Supreme Court by President Trump's lawyers in the important immunity argument recently, I think, was a very reasonable position, and they urged the court to apply a similar rule fashioned in the D.C. Circuit in a case that I'm handling for President Trump. It's a civil case involving, it's now a combination of members of Congress and Capitol Police and other people involved in January 6th. Who are suing President Trump for those activities. And then the answer is, then the rule is, well, he has immunity. And he, because of this impeachment remedy, he really has immunity for anything that he does as President Trump. But he can be called to account for candidate Trump behavior. And then there's a number of other rules that apply there, because candidate Trump behavior was all protected by the First Amendment. So that's itself a dispositive grounds to get rid of those issues. And so that's a reasonable rule. They aren't saying, hey, I'm president, I get to do whatever I want, I'm like the king. No, but the sheer real estate occupied by what you can do as president is vast in our country. And what the left is arguing and was arguing in that ruling is we should limit that immunity to only those things that only the president can do, which is not the rule that the United States has ever applied before. It's a very narrow rule. It effectively makes the president a mere figurehead who appoints ambassadors and grants pardons and, you know, signs a few pieces of paper and nothing else. So that's not our system of government. Our system of government is with a powerful, robust executive branch that is co-equal to the other branches, and these president has unique powers. And so president has an absolute right to communicate to Congress about the poor functioning of a federal election. He has an absolute right to do that. He has a First Amendment right to do that as a candidate, and he has an executive right to do that as a president of the United States, to urge investigations, urge inquiries. He has those rights. And so I would argue that pretty much everything that is at issue there should be immunized. And by the way, he went through two impeachments and he was not convicted.
That's the point.
You know, there should be some due process there. The idea that they can just keep dragging presidents before tribunals decades after they were president or years after they were president is fundamentally at odds with our entire system and framework of government. I mean, look, in this world, we have so-called democracies like Pakistan, where you never leave office peacefully. You get, you know, blown up in an airplane or shot, or, you know, you are exiled. Like, we don't want that in America. And so presidents should be allowed to do their job broadly construed and then leave office peacefully, the only remedy being high crimes and misdemeanors for the most part while they're in office. And after they're in office, too late to do that either. And so I think that we are really at a crossroads. And I feel encouraged by some of the questions and some of the hypotheticals posed by the court, that there seems to be a majority for that middle ground that says that anything that is done as president is immunized. And, you know, then the lower courts will have to confront, what do you do with the rest of the conduct?
Well, I hope you're right with that cautious optimism. You know, we could go on for hours, and I know I don't want to take your time to do that, but I'm going to have you back. Thanks a lot, Harmeet, for joining me. There's so many important issues. I never knew how important it was to have a lawyer in your family. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you for listening to The Independent with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Harmeet Dhillon, watch for her expert commentary on the news and in social media. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube, as well as on Spotify, Apple, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now. And I'll see you next time.